Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, an in-depth look at Colombia with Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, and Temash Tayani, who's just back from Colombia. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. So, Colombia, it's in South America. In fact, it's part of one of the hilly areas. And we're joined by Temash Tayani, who's actually come back around about 6 weeks ago, was it, Temash?
Nearly 2 months now.
Okay. First of all, what took you out there in the first place?
I was trying to live on the land here, and we came up against a very big hurdle insofar as you don't own land here. The Queen leases it to you, or the Crown leases it to you.
And well, hang on a minute, because a lot of people who bought their freeholds, who think they own their land, that might be news to them. They might actually be a little bit worried about the fact that a freehold doesn't actually entirely entitle you to the land.
Well, for sure, if they were to go and try to do anything on that land that is outside of its rubber stamp documents, try and make it, if it's agricultural, they want to do something commercial or industrial or residential, then they're going to come against problems, and they'll soon find that that land is not actually theirs. It's all leased to them by the Crown.
Okay, so you decided to go to another country where it was actually you were able to do what you wanted to do. Is that why you were over there?
More or less, yes. Or at least to have the freedom to live how I thought humanity should live, which is free on the land.
Right. So how did you find whereabouts you ended, where did you end up staying?
Well, we were putting on an event in the place we're living here in England, or in Wales, actually, better said. And in that moment, during the whole process, we met some Colombians. And there's just something there in the Latin American spirit, the Latin American people. They just have something almost like raw, organic humanity left in them. And I sort of felt something there and something special in them. And there they started speaking to me about a lot of the control grid in this country, which at first I didn't really understand or I sort of agreed. But actually going to Colombia, I can see how deep that control is and how far that stretches back in the history.
Well, give us a bit of insight. That's fascinating. If you've got foreigners actually teaching you something about Britain, saying there's a control grid here, what do you mean by that?
Well, it works on a lot of levels. I mean, for instance, one of the Colombians that came, he looked at the churches all around the country, and I knew that the churches were all grown on the sort of sacred sites where you used to have yew trees, and they cut the yew trees down. They used the yew trees to then melt the rock to make cannons. And so all the sacred sites, all the yew trees there, helped imperialism by making cannons and blowing up all the people they needed to blow up that were in the way. And then they built the churches, and then around the churches they buried their dead in the graveyards. And so when you look at that, of all the sacred sites in this country, how they're now just totally surrounded by the cemeteries and graveyards, and those are all the original sacred sites of this country. And that's just one aspect of that control grid.
Well, I mean, some people will say, you know, look at the pre-Christian, the sort of barrows right across Wiltshire, for example. I mean, it's a similar kind of thing. People wanted somewhere sacred to leave their loved ones when they passed on.
That's true. And usually they'd use, in the past, there would be the elm tree that would have been sacred and would have been the tree that you'd have buried your dead near, and it wouldn't have been near yew trees. And now we know with the elm tree, there's a disease with them and they're going out of fashion. They're all dying.
Well, yeah, so the control grid, though, surely more is really around money. I mean, obviously, in Colombia, it's a little bit easier to get your hands on land than it is here in Britain. And actually, it's land that which people thrive on. They can build their homes on, they can build a workshop on the land, they can actually grow food in the land. And are there still places in Colombia where people can just grow without having to pay rent to anyone?
I mean, I think so. There's no, as far as we're aware, there's no rent or there's no kind of, you know, taxes like you get here, of the enormous taxes that you get just for being on the land here. And pretty much there is still free rein, depending where you are. And obviously in the jungle, that's still, how to say, hasn't been sold yet.
Because that's another thing here. If you started trying to just grow some vegetables and put up a shack on a bit of land in Britain, you're not going to last long. Anyway, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, can you just give us a little bit of the context? Because right now there's negotiations going on, aren't there, between South American Colombian factions. They're not actually taking place within Colombia. They're taking place in Cuba and supervised by the Norwegians. The idea is that this is all going to be very fair and that the civil war, effectively, that's been going on in Colombia for decades may stand some chance of being negotiated here. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'll just show what my interest in Colombia is. I'm a member of Colombia's Solidarity Campaign, and I actually visited Colombia fairly briefly in 2005 on a delegation for the representing British trade unions. The civil war in Colombia, which has been raging since the 1940s, is very much about land and access to land. And one of the sticking points in the negotiations between the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, and the regime in Bogotá is this whole idea of land reform, access to land, allowing people basically to look after themselves by subsistence agriculture. You've got a very high concentration of land ownership in Colombia, like in other Latin American countries, where most of the best land is in the hands of big landowners who want to grow coffee or palm oil has become a very big crop in recent years, sugar, all of which can be very destructive for the traditional way of life of indigenous communities and other poorer Colombians. For example, freed slaves in the 1880s all went to live on the land, and this struggle has been going on. So one of the sticking points in the negotiations is the government in Bogotá prepared to give people access to land? And the Norwegians, who've been helping to facilitate the discussions, have been trying to encourage the government of Santos, who is the current president, to not just say let's have peace, put down the guns, let's stop killing each other. And of course, a lot of people have been killed in Colombia. It's been very, very brutal civil war that's been going on. And land, access to land is one of the key demands of the people in general and of the guerrillas in particular.
Yeah, that's it's actually really important, isn't it? Something we've kind of lost sight of here in Britain is that we really need to have our own bit of land, even just to get started. I mean, for many people, that is a mortgage, and of course, that takes decades to pay off. But anyway, Temash, can you just give us an idea of people you stayed with, had they managed to find somewhere reasonably permanent to stay, where they could do subsistence farming and then maybe have a little bit of a surplus to trade with the outside world and at least live?
Well, these people, they started in the jungle as an indigenous community, and this is like anything between 20, 30 years ago they started getting established, and about 20 years ago, 13 years ago, the civil war came to them, just as it extends further and further into nature, and they had to flee. They have now come under the banner of displaced indigenous, which is now in the hundreds of thousands of people out there, and so they've relocated to a place that is, agricultural commercial land. You don't have any rainforest trees there because you've cut one tree down, you can't leave one tree left, so you cut down the whole area, and then that becomes, the commercially viable area.
And one of the things that was really worried me about what's happening over there, I know you were saying to me just before we started that some of the people, you buy fair trade coffee here. That's one of the things. The two things Colombia is known for is its coffee and its cocaine. But with the coffee, at least you hope that if you're buying fair trade coffee, that's actually helping the right people in Colombia.
Well, it does what it says in the tin, but that extra money goes to the farmers in Colombia. But who are those farmers? Who are they connected to? For instance, at the moment, there's been a national strike in Colombia, specifically from the coffee growers, because there's so much coffee being grown now that it's just flooding the market, and there's no way of them making a living through coffee anymore. And during this whole process of the national strike and all the coffee growers united to fight against the corruption, we've found that there are coffee growers who are connected to these groups, to fair trade groups, specifically to Rainforest Alliance, that they still crop their coffee and they still sell it for a good price. And they themselves are the richer landowners and the ones that when the smaller farmers, that they can't sell their coffee, they can't actually grow anything, they end up working for these bigger companies. And we've known people who've basically tried to take them to court because of violence, because of threats, and they found that their corruption and they have a protection at a governmental local council level that's connected to all these fair trade supposedly institutes.
But I mean, surely that's to do with the fact that they're trying to strike. I mean, obviously, if they can't get unity amongst all the coffee growers, then there's not much point in striking.
Well, that is an interesting subject there, because what the governments are trying to do and the way they're trying to overcome this strike is that they're then trying to section off certain individuals and certain people who are, say, dedicated to one crop, be it coffee, potatoes, sugar, bananas, plantains. And the ones, the coffee, the farmers who grow, who are dedicated to those crops, they're small in number, they're in the bigger farms, and the government really only want to get in contact, only want to be in negotiation with these farmers. And the actual smaller subsistence farmers, they're the ones who really, they cannot buy the membership to fair trade. They cannot ever produce the coffee necessary to actually to join that cabal of people.
Martin, this sounds a little bit dodgy, doesn't it? I mean, the idea that you're buying coffee, which is actually helping people who are undermining the subsistence farmers, the poorest in Colombia. What about those who are actually working on these farms? Are they properly employed? In other words, are they given any kind of permanent jobs? Or are they just day labourers like, you know, we have over here now, these zero-hour contracts where you actually may not get paid at all?
A lot of the labourers over there, they get paid in the coffee that they pick, that they then carry to the places to sell them, because the farmer themselves knows that they cannot afford to pay that worker and then sell their coffee. So they pick the coffee, they sell it. And these are the smaller farmers that people in this country would think that the fair trade organisations would be going to. But when you get a big, when you get a country like Colombia where corruption is so woven into the system, the idea that some do-gooding fair trade company is going there and is doing a Robin Hood mission and really putting that money into the poor farmers is a joke.
Well, yes, that's really, it's fascinating to get a bit of insight as to what really goes on the ground. Martin, on the other side, the cocaine, tell us a bit about the cocaine trade, because we've been hearing for decades now about this war on drugs, and yet it doesn't seem to have really been getting anywhere. How does this international trade in cocaine operate?
Well, the Plan Colombia was brought in during the Clinton era, and it was a basically massive US financial and military support to so-called suppress the coca trade. But in actual fact, Colombian cocaine in the 1980s was being transported to the United States by the CIA and the Contras in Nicaragua in order to fund the Nicaraguan Contras in their struggle to overthrow the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. So the United States government is fantastically hypocritical in its so-called war on drugs in Latin America. It's basically an excuse to intervene in countries where they've got other interests. So the war on drugs is essentially a cover for their other activities. And of course, Uribe, who was the former president of Colombia, was named by the DEA in the US as a major drug dealer. And he basically, although he was a US ally, was a major drug dealer. And Convivencia, which was the right-wing paramilitaries, which then became Auto Unidas Defensas de Colombia, and they've now become the Black Eagles and various other organisations. These right-wing paramilitary organisations were dealing cocaine with the full knowledge and understanding of the United States government and basically given a nod and a wink. So what goes on, and people in Latin America are very well aware of this, if you are the right kind of drug dealer, the US government winks and nods and lets you get away with what you're doing. If you're the wrong kind of drug dealer, then they'll throw everything at you to get rid of the competition. And people are very cynical about it. And I think across the political spectrum in Latin America now, from Mexico down to the southern cone, there's a real push on now to legalise all drugs, because people are dying every day to enforce this so-called prohibition, which has become a farce and a joke.
Well, there's obviously a massive trade in these cocaine and in other illegal drugs going on. Where does the money go to that's made out of this drugs trade? And you're saying that some of the intelligence agencies, the governments, are actually turning a blind eye to it, the military.
Well, there's a UN report on drugs and crime that came out in 2009, basically drawn up by police officers working with the UN, and it was absolutely clear where the money went. It went to bail the banks out. Without the cocaine money and the heroin money, the banks would have collapsed in 2008-2009. At that stage, all of the so-called illegal dirty money went sloshing through the system like a tsunami. And HSBC were convicted, if you remember, not long ago, of money laundering in Mexico. And they got a minuscule fine in terms of the money they'd made, and they just went back to business as usual. That's the real world, folks. We're busting teenagers for smoking a joint. Meanwhile, the banking system is being propped up by the drug cartels.
And what about you mentioned Iran-Contra. I mean, there's gun running too going on as part of this?
Mina Air Base in Arkansas was being used by the CIA and the Nicaraguan Contras. They were flying in light planes full of cocaine, and then they were flying out planes full of weaponry for the war in Nicaragua. And incidentally, there was a crash of a light plane in northern Mexico a couple of years ago, full of cocaine, fairly standard stuff. The police impounded it. The last time that plane was seen was on the tarmac at Glasgow Airport, being used by the CIA for extraordinary rendition. So what have we got here? Let's just be absolutely clear. The Western intelligence services have been involved in drug dealing for a very long time. The whole war in Afghanistan in the 1980s was funded with heroin. There's no doubt about it. The evidence is in. And at the same time, this war on drugs is pushed down everybody's throats as a means of intervening in these countries, keeping all... I mean, the Colombian military, basically, have been used to try and suppress the armed uprising under the cover of a war on drugs. So they call the FARC narco-guerrillas and so on. FARC basically does make money from drugs, but then so does everybody else. I mean, they would just say, well, that's the only money that goes... You know, we protect the farmers and we tax them, and that's how we fund our activities.
How has this all translated it out on the ground, Tomáš? I mean, what evidence have you seen of this trade in your time in Colombia?
Obviously, when I say I'm in Colombia or I mention Colombia, it's like a word association game and everyone goes, ah, Colombia, cocaine, violence. And it's interesting there because in the Colombia, 50% of the population are rural, what they would call peasant farmers or campesinos. And really being there on the ground, you do not see, like, the regular peasant farmers carrying cocaine, growing cocaine, or anything like this. Obviously, in the bigger cities, you do have these problems. And even then, I haven't actually seen any of the white powder. And everything that I've seen in terms of social degeneration has come from is one of the raw ingredients to the cocaine, which I think they call their bazooki or bazooka. And that is basically something that's destroying the youth there. And that's one of the raw ingredients, like the black sludge, before you then purify it, apparently, to then get the real good stuff, apparently.
Martin, you're nodding there.
Yeah, well, bazooka is what's left when you've made the stuff that you sell to the high end, you know, yuppie type stuff.
Hey, that is.
And what you got left is bazooka, which is the poor people.
So this is basically a byproduct from refining cocaine into the Western market, and this is sold out in cocaine.
Yeah, but
I think
Tomáš would also agree that traditionally in Latin America, coca rather than cocaine has been very much part of traditional culture and has been for thousands of years. So yeah. I was watching a program, Lost Kingdoms of Latin America, on the BBC 4 last night, and it was quite clear that the Cogi, who are a Colombian tribe, they're using coca every day as they have done for thousands of years.
There are tribes in Colombia that survived all the repression and all the invasion of the Spanish, and they practically have survived through coca, and they themselves see it as a very sacred plant and just a gift from Pachamama, as they say over there. And they also had a prophecy that the white man would come and turn it into something of a means of destruction, just like the yew tree here was sacred, and that became the tool which they used as imperialism. And it's the same over there with their sacred plants as well.
Tomáš, tell us a little bit more about the strikes that are going on at the moment. What's the motivation for it? You mentioned these briefly, but you know, obviously, when someone is taking away their labour and actually having then trouble surviving, it takes quite a lot to do that. So, what's the motivation behind it? What is they hoping to achieve?
Well, really, they're just hoping to get the freedom to live as they have always lived and their ancestors have lived. And obviously, at the moment, it's the case that the bigger fish is coming up and eating the smaller fish. At the moment, a very big fish has moved in terms of genetically modified crops from North America that has basically flooded the market over there, much cheaper than all the grains and all their native seeds over there. There is a new law that's come out that Santos has pushed, and that it makes their own native seeds illegal. And they can only use genetically modified Monsanto seeds. The sister company to Monsanto over there is called Bienestar, which means well-being, just as Monsanto means my saint.
Okay, so how does this work, though? I mean, is it the supermarkets are... I mean, I would have thought that subsistence farmers wouldn't even be using supermarkets.
I think mainly most of the peasant farmers themselves, they appreciate and they have a solidarity amongst them of the situation. But because of the fast development of the country and all the media and the way, I say, modernisation is basically touching every corner of that country where roads and the TVs go in, to a lot of people, they just see the media. And obviously, we've had, if we like this country, it's here, Great Britain has been like the guinea pig of the sort of destruction of the community spirit, putting everyone into boxes, giving everyone a box to watch. And it's destroying something, so people do not have the information. And obviously, they demonise or they ridicule the people who are obviously more peasants or the more sort of archetypal peoples, if they are the ones who are dragging the country into the mud and stopping them from progressing.
Well, one of the things we've definitely lost over here is a sort of community memory of how to organise amongst, you know, within communities. So, yes, the use of the word guerrilla, I mean, this is maybe not really fair to describe FARC as the guerrillas and also the ordinary indigenous people, because the fact that they're fighting back is actually quite a positive thing when what they're fighting effectively is a sort of fascist state. Martin, what's going on along those lines about, you know, sort of communities
I think ordinary people don't want to be regarded as armed opponents of the state just because they disagree with state policy. And of course, it's always been the goal of the state to make everybody who opposes things like development projects and so on to be guerrillas or guerrilla sympathisers. And in actual fact, the accusation of being a guerrilla sympathiser has allowed the militarisation of rural areas of Colombia, and then people are driven off their traditional lands. And it turns out that those traditional lands have got oil, gold, diamonds, or other natural resources underneath them. So in actual fact, the war has been used by big companies as a means of driving away people who are basically, you know, traditional farmers, and to get their land off them without having to pay compensation or even to negotiate with them in any way. And a lot of rural people in Colombia see this as a scam, basically, to get rid of their traditional way of life.
Timash, how aware do you think are most Native Americans and the people you were staying with of these various systems to, you know, what's going on in other parts of the world, which is bringing about oppression for them effectively? I mean, particularly with the drugs trade, the big international coffee markets, that kind of thing.
In terms of the genetical modification and the crops that come from the United States and their seeds, a lot of people and a lot of the media have plugged it up to be something absolutely very good. And you go to the markets there where you'd have like one stall, which might be more commercially focused, and they have these great big tomatoes, and you can pick up tomato and say, "Do you know there's a gene spliced in this tomato of a fish?" And they would stick their thumbs up and smile and say, "Yeah, it sounds great." And you go to the smaller marketplaces where they got their own traditional tomatoes, and when you speak to them, they cannot afford to buy these other seeds. So it's not out of awareness that they're sticking with their old seeds, actually out of poverty. They don't have the time to go and research, and they just collect their own seeds. They've just been doing what they've been doing for the last, you know, for intergenerational. And obviously it's a severe lack of education on that front for them.
Yeah, well, I mean, surely, if people are buying seeds from these seed companies like Monsanto for these sort of giant tomatoes, does that mean that the seeds will only just last for one crop and then the seeds become useless? So these subsistence farmers and other people in agriculture have to keep going back and buying more?
I haven't seen, in terms of the big, like tomatoes, for instance, and we have seen people and known people who basically planted the seed after seed, but now they introduced a new law there which makes all that illegal for them to retain their native seeds. And in terms of suicide seed, I haven't actually seen that myself, but then again, the main people who use all the suicide seeds or the main big Monsanto crops, like you say, it's not the individual small farmer, it's the bigger farming cartels, and really wouldn't imagine to get much truth from them anyway if you're to ask them just a fairly simple question.
Okay, we're going to hear a bit more about the future in Colombia, some positive things and some more threats that there might be to the country after some music.
Make you wanna move, yeah, dance.
Bob Marley. Sun is Shining, the Funk Star Deluxe Remix 1999 there. Another subject when you're talking about South America. A lot of people actually over there, as well as some here, talk about assassinations. Martin, we've been hearing recently about the chap we were just hearing that from, Bob Marley. What do you know about that?
Well, I mean, there was certainly an attempt to assassinate him by Jamaica Labour Party gangsters in the 1970s because of his perceived People's National Party loyalties, although Marley himself didn't claim to have any such loyalties. I mean, political violence is there, and it's certainly there in Colombia.
But there are allegations that he was actually killed by the Americans, weren't there?
Well, there are, and indeed plenty of people in America, in Colombia, are killed by the government, which is the Americans, and maybe but also the British as well.
I mean, didn't he get cancer, Bob Marley? And there were some allegations that it was in his, it was some sort of spike in.
Well, we don't know. But I mean, the fact is that there was definitely an attempt to kill him with a gun, which was carried out for political reasons. But that's fairly common stuff in Colombia. During the 1980s, the FARC actually called a ceasefire, stood 3,000 candidates in local elections across Colombia. Every one of those candidates was assassinated, all 3,000. And at that point, they called off the ceasefire and went back to the mountains. I mean, that's the situation in the past in Colombia. And when I was over there on the delegation in 2005, people I was speaking to were assassinated subsequently. And they also killed a homeless person around the corner from us in Bogota with a small bomb.
What was the point of that?
Well, the local trade union leader said to us, well, they wouldn't try and kill you because you're foreigners and that would create a problem. But by killing him, they're sending a message. And it's a violent place for those who stand up for justice, and it always has been. But people are incredibly brave, and I went to meet brave people, and I wasn't disappointed.
There's quite a lot of evidence that Hugo Chavez may have been poisoned as well. Any thoughts on that, either of you?
It's something that he himself has said, that his cancer was something that was given to him by the United States or by the CIA, and it's been known for the last decade or so that the CIA has drugs and means of giving people certain cancers in order to knock them off. And really, in Venezuela, that's something that is not superstition, but something that is very believable.
Martin, is there any evidence of that?
Well, the CIA themselves have boasted of their 40-plus attempts to kill Fidel Castro, and they're quite proud of it. So when you say that, would they kill somebody like Chavez? The answer is yes, they would.
And aren't there South American leaders also who've died of cancer?
Yes, I think that's what Chavez
pointed out. Hugo was talking about that, wasn't he? Yeah, so this is the climate that's over there. Thousands of people standing for elections being killed. Leaders of countries who are a little bit radical and maybe a bit socialist and anti-United States getting killed. So this is pretty frightening. It's good to hear, though, that Temesh, that there are some senators who are brave enough to speak out against the regime. This one, Piedad Córdoba, I probably haven't pronounced her name correctly.
Piedad Córdoba. She was a senator that was involved in the government. And obviously, when you're involved at that level, she obviously saw the corruption and she got disillusioned. So she left politics. And then after building up a bit of force, came back. And people have likened her to the female Chavez of Latin America. Friends there who say, and also this has apparently been confirmed as well, that Venezuela recently bought fighter jets from the United States, and that the actual peace talks of between the guerrillas in Colombia and the Colombian government is a step, because now they have that infrastructure in place to then do the war against Venezuela that the US have been wanting to do now for a very long time.
So that's one main side effect, possibly, of the ending of the civil war, is that Colombia, Martin, might focus its guns on the next-door neighbour in Venezuela.
Yes, it's true, but I think, on the other hand, Chavez, when he was alive, was very much involved in bringing together the Colombian government and the FARC. And I think that people, there is real hope about this peace process, despite the disappointments of the past. Santos isn't quite the same as Uribe. Uribe was basically a criminal and should be basically taken to the European, to the International Criminal Court. Santos is a more, Santos has committed his regime to making these peace talks work, and he's got people on his side who are not happy with him talking. And I think there's more realism about the talks this time, in the sense that, for example, there's been no ceasefire. The fighting has continued because nobody trusts both sides don't trust each other. But the talks do seem to be progressing, and some hope is that this terrible civil war that's been raging for decades can be brought to an end.
But in terms of what Piedad Córdoba is bringing to light over there and trying to communicate to the people, is that the current President Santos, he was the defence minister for Uribe. And so the actual, just logistically looking at that and knowing that the defence minister had all the crimes of Uribe, he was almost like the next in line or was very much in that link. And so the idea that Santos is like the better face of Colombia, when you put that in that context of him being the defence minister of one of the most brutal drug trafficking dictators out there, voted in, possibly, then you have to question the whole public image of the Santos and why. For instance, there, Córdoba says a very good thing of that. In the media there, there's always some debate between Santos and Uribe, and Uribe is criticising Santos, and he shouldn't be doing like this, he should change all the, you know, the specifically with the talks with the FARC. But it's, how to say, like, created division, where they're on the same side, they've got the same, they're covering each other's crimes, but they're just pretending to be the opposition to each other, so...
Not Martin, it sounds to me what Tamash is saying there, that you may have bought a bit of spin about this new president. I mean, this is a little bit worrying, isn't it, when the guy who was responsible for some of the worst crimes under the previous president is now made president. He may look a bit better, his image might be different on the TV, he may have a nicer, shinier suit, but is he actually going to be any better?
Well, I think that's for those who are negotiating with him to decide. If FARC decides that they want to carry on the fight, then I think it is actually incumbent on the rest of the world to respect that decision. But if they decide that for the sake of the ordinary people, if they're prepared to talk and try and find a negotiated compromise, that is for them to do.
But it doesn't say a lot about democracy, does it? If you've got someone who's democratically elected, who's not only an international drug dealer, but also a violent totalitarian.
Well, when you say democratically elected, you've got to remember that only a minority of people end up going to the polls.
But
in
it
Colombia.
Is a democracy.
No, well, it is a kind of a democracy, but as I said, when FARC tried to stand their candidates in the election, they were all murdered. And that's quite frequently happens. Trade union leaders are frequently murdered. Campesino leaders are frequently murdered. What kind of democracy is that when anybody who stands for election who is in any way radical gets murdered? That's not a democracy, is it?
And there also were townships out there that basically were led to the election polls by the paramilitaries to vote for Uribe.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like much of a real democracy at all. Martin, I mean, this it's all very well, because the thing is, many of us in this part of the world don't actually know much about the details. We would figure, oh, if it's a democracy, then it's got to be better than a dictatorship. But, I mean, you may have countries which are, with a benevolent dictator, would actually function a hell of a lot better than Colombia.
Well, you could argue that people in Cuba, by and large, are better off than the poorest sections of society in Colombia, and that's possibly true. I think ultimately democracy is winning in the rest of Latin America. You've still got tremendous social injustice, even in countries like like Venezuela, which have made big progress in the last decades. You've still got a small minority of extremely wealthy people and a large number of people who get very, very, very little out of the system. But I don't think we should throw away the baby with the bathwater. Genuine democracy, which gives people real hope of social justice, is surely the way forward if we can make it work.
In Venezuela, could it happen in Colombia?
Well, that is obviously the...
Really?
Yes, I think it could. The problem is that the people like Chavez have been killed off in Venezuela, in Colombia. You see, that's the problem. In the dirty war in Argentina, 30,000 people were killed by the regime. Those 30,000 people are the people that should be running Argentina now. But, of course, they're all dead. And that what you're left with, this was made very clear to me in Colombia, they're saying, what we have to do, our leaders expect to be murdered, and therefore they have to train up other people to take over their roles. But, of course, the people coming forward to take over those roles are not nearly as gifted as the people who get murdered. Well, they've got to start from scratch each time.
A little bit like the Breivik murders in Norway, where the potential future leaders of the country for the Labour Party were murdered by Breivik.
Precisely.
Timash, what are your thoughts about the future? Because... is there possibility for a sort of Chavez figure in Colombia, or is it simply going to be a whole queue and everyone will have a choice between 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different totalitarian drug-dealing dictators?
There is definitely hope there amongst the people, and they say the battle is never lost until one loses hope, and if it's something that the Latin American people have, it's a tremendous amount of hope. When the Allende government in Chile was overthrown by Pinochet, after that process there of that country gradually going up towards socialism, and not talking of the communist style of socialism where the government owns the state and the people, but where socialism where the people are the will of the people, are the government and own the land. And when Pinochet came in, it was a massive attack against the socialism. And in one generation, you had a whole nation basically on its knees and then ready to accept all the dictates of the World Free Trade Agreement and all this. In Colombia, that war's been going on for so long that they say the tactic of just bringing in a dictator that would do something real bloody, I mean, they've already had that under the pretext of democracy. And so the general saying there is that they cannot just use the old tactic of bringing a dictator and overthrow the regime. And so they're in an interesting position now where everything stands on knife point. And specifically when you look at things like that a lot of the cocaine for the super rich is now moving out of Colombia, and it makes you wonder, are they still expecting Colombia to be their lapdog, or is there going to be something inside? A lot of people there speak of insurrection, of revolution, which is something, it's almost an unforgotten word here. But there, the people on the ground, even though they're not educated, they feel that and they hope for that, and there's a lot of hope there.
Well, that's good news. Also, you've mentioned to me before we started the show that the Chinese are taking quite an interest, and specifically, potentially anyway, looking for gathering the water, because Colombia has some of the best water supplies for South America. Obviously, it's on the equator, very hot, and some parts of that part of the world, water is really the most important commodity around.
In all of Latin America, Colombia has the most water per area than any other part of Latin America, and you have the phenomenon that it's on the equator, you've got the Andes, so you have a lot of rain that's put through the mountain system that goes through these huge rivers, and in those river basins, which have their own ecosystems that are specific to Colombia itself, they're now being bought out, sold out to the Chinese. Actually, they were sold a long, long time ago, and now the guerrilla warfare is all kind of dying down, and there's this peace. Now big business have gone in there and have started building these dams. Not only with China as well, there's a company from Spain, and there's in all, there's a plan for 33 dams being built. In one of these dams, the Chinese uncovered gold, because in this area, they say there's a lot of buried gold in that area, and that this gold has curses, or this gold has a certain magic of it. And for some reason, as if by magic, the Chinese just seem to know where that gold is, and they've managed to buy the land where that gold is, and they've uncovered it. And because that's their land, they've bought it, they've just taken it back to their bank vaults.
Amazing. Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts about the sort of general politics of water? Because it's becoming more important. Quite clearly in the Middle East, it's very important. Is this part of a sort of a wider resource war where big companies, powerful countries, empires are trying to grab water supplies around us?
Yes, and I think Colombia has probably got the widest cross-section of raw materials, not just water. They've got everything else. They've got gold, oil, diamonds. They've got lots of good agricultural land. They've only got a population of 37 million people. And if it was a properly managed place, there is no reason why it shouldn't be a prosperous place for everybody. Yep. But, of course, the problem with having all of these resources is that people want to steal them, whoever they are, whether it's big companies or maybe the Chinese. Although what the Venezuelans have been doing is doing deals with the Chinese as a way of getting out from under the pressure of the Americans. And, it's a shame that people who live in such a potentially wealthy country live in such miserable poverty and such horrible conditions.
Temash, do you think it's better for them to be doing deals with the Chinese and the Americans?
It really depends how much you've read and which side of the coin. There are some people that say it's all a part of the same control mechanism. When someone is that focused on money and profits and resources, really they're in the same playground, be it under what banner or what flag.
Yeah, okay. Finally, many of us hear about Colombia as a very dangerous country. What would you say to people who are thinking about visiting it?
There are dangers out there, and there are a lot of red zones. If you go into the south and the places that are not very well built up in the jungle, then you do have a lot of factions that will cause problems, and there are still kidnappings that happen in those areas. And obviously, they're red zones. But it's a bit of a delicate situation, because you also have red zones that are not red zones because they're dangerous to the tourists. They're dangerous because if the tourists saw what was happening in those red zones, and then they brought that to the international community, that would look very embarrassing for the Colombian society, and they're very image conscious of their own country. I certainly recommend to people that there is the stereotypical threat that you see of Colombia really is not as powerful as it is, and actually you can go through a lot of the country and just meet a whole bunch of very good human beings.
For anyone thinking about visiting Colombia, obviously you can go over there on a little package tour, you can stay somewhere for a few weeks, but I mean, what would you say to anyone thinking about maybe wanting to get a bit of real life and go off the beaten track?
Well, for myself, I had the luck and the privilege to go off the beaten track because I met Colombians in this country, and they're the ones who I went to stay with. And in that sense, being there, I managed to then get very well acquainted with the culture and with the campesino life. So it is definitely worth having having contacts and knowing people. But then you find in Latin America, it's not like the London Underground. You can actually meet and speak to a lot of people, and people will take you in, and people will really help you and clothe you. As I say, there's no social system out there, which means that people work hard and that people look after each other. And if anyone's going out there to actually work or to do something to help the people, with a good heart, they will find the people they need. In that sense, you could go stay on the beaten track, and gradually you could meet the people where they would be able to take you to more remote places. Some of them are red zones, but it's important to know that not all the red zones are red because it's a danger to the tourists, but because of the regime.
Sounds like it's good that there's still some places on this planet you can go and have an adventure.
Yes.
Right. Okay, Tamash, and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
And I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos again for our news review. Hi, Jason. Welcome to Dialect.
Hey, Tony.
What you got for us this week?
We've got this piece from Monday's Daily Express.
Okay.
SAS ordered to kill Diana.
You mean the SAS, not the SS?
No, I thought I said SAS.
SAS.
I don't know. Depends who you're asking, I suppose.
So the Daily Express. This is an interesting newspaper. One wonders whether maybe that some of these Diana stories are to increase their circulation. But what's the actual story?
The story is that the ex-wife of Soldier N, the soldier that originally put out the story, has done her best to back up his claims.
Okay, and so even though both of them, this couple, are both at loggerheads with each other, they're both agreeing on the same story, that this was sort of currency amongst SAS people, that it was a secret operation to kill Diana. What do you think? Is any credibility? Because none of the other papers, this is one of the things that amazes me about these Diana stories. The Private Eye, various other people always say, no, of course she wasn't killed, it was just a normal accident. And the Daily Express seems to be saying completely the opposite, and the, never the two will meet. Occasionally there's a documentary about Diana, which seems to show some kind of conspiracy or other. You know, even if it's to fit up the photographers or something like that, because I mean that was clearly there was a premeditated attempt to try and make sure that the photographers took the rap for Diana's killing. So, what are your thoughts about, you know, the rights or wrongs of what the Express is doing, and what actually happened back in 1997?
It's certainly interesting that two people supposed to be at loggerheads have come up with exactly the same story. On the other hand, the Daily Express has been publishing stories about Diana for many years, so...
I noticed over the weekend in the Sunday Express, Donald McIntyre had actually been talking to some SAS people, and he was saying that that the flash device is actually a standard part of the SAS's kit, which was apparently used to disorientate the driver in the tunnel, and that it couldn't have been done unless it had been done in a tunnel. So it seems to be quite a lot of information coming out about, even though we've already had an inquest, which was 10 years late, but there was an inquest, even though it was by the Royal Coroner. So I guess this one's going to run on and on, Jason.
Indeed, yeah. I mean...
Well, a more current story is, of course, Syria, and Cameron apparently is giving us a warning about Syria. What warning is he giving us?
Yes, he's saying that Syria is a Holocaust waiting to happen.
And so why did he want to actually sort of pour petrol on the flames there, then?
Well, what's happened is that the UN chief, Ban Ki-moon, has said that there is evidence of sarin, nerve gas, being used, and that this is a war crime. Now, what it does say here is it doesn't actually say who used it, But I think David Cameron Coe is saying that it's been used by the Syrian forces.
Well, who cares, to be honest with you? Well, who cares what David Cameron says? He's not coming up with any evidence. The UN is saying, yes, it's been used, but we don't know who's used it. And, of course, that is the sort of thing that's likely to happen. If somebody uses chemical weapons, it's not going to be very easy to find out who it was that actually put them there.
Mm-hmm. Zan says the UN team wasn't asked to determine who was responsible.
Right.
Just to determine that whether or not they had been used.
Okay, well, I mean, of course, that's part of the neutrality of the UN. So what we're getting is a sort of blame game, isn't it? A kind of constant blame game all the time. Somebody's saying that it's these people who are responsible for it. This, I find, rather irritating and insulting, the way the press sort of constantly puts on people who are saying one thing or another thing.
I thought it was kind of disingenuous, Cameron, to compare it to the Holocaust.
Well, yes, that's true. Although, of course, it could really take off there, especially if the Russians move in and the Americans start fighting the Russians in Syria. Could be very, very nasty. Washington this week, a shooting.
Yes, really very sad story here. A gunman, two gunmen, possibly even three gunmen if you...
Well, it looks now like only one, I think.
Yes, anyway, a gunman, Aaron Alexis, who lived in Brooklyn, New York, had opened fire in, it was the Navy Yard of Washington, and has killed 12 people, and he himself was killed.
Now, I noticed the BBC this week has been saying, it's another wildcat shooting spree, mad person, but obviously this is nothing like Sandy Hook, even though they keep comparing it to it. This was a military compound that this took place in, and in fact it's part of the US Navy's control center, even making decisions about what's happening in the Eastern Mediterranean. So this is starting to get very, very close to the US internal military side of the war effort in Syria. I mean, this guy is an ex-military reservist, isn't he? An ex-naval, US Naval Reserve guy who's done this and then been killed. I mean, you know, he's a Buddhist, apparently. He used to pray regularly about what was happening to do with wars and things like this.
Buddhist?
Yeah. And
That's an interesting religion for a naval reservist.
Well, yes. He's, and you know, is it not? I mean, apparently he hated his commanding officer as well who worked in there. So... You know, it looks to me as if this is a kind of blue-on-blue type situation where you've got, you know, one side basically infighting within the same unit where this guy was taking out revenge of some sort and almost making a political statement possibly about the way that the war in Syria was being transpired. Any more facts you got there on this then?
Yes, well, we heard that he was an aviation electrician's mate, third class, in December 2009. He was assigned to the Fleet Logistics Support Squadron 46 at the air station in Fort Worth. He was actually awarded the Global War on Terrorism Service Medal and the National Defence Service Medal. So this guy's been involved in stuff.
Yeah, he was an IT guy, wasn't he? So he was obviously on the internet reading a lot about what was going on, and also working for Hewlett-Packard, or big company, a defence computer servicing company, which is owned by Hewlett-Packard.
And therefore they might be moving out of Bristol before too long.
Well, maybe, if it's a defence company, probably a wise idea. Okay, finally, gay footballers.
Yeah, I thought I'd end the story in a story of hope. This is... This is actually a good turn from Queen's Park Rangers resident nutcase Joey Barton, but this time he's come out with something good. He's decided to wear rainbow. Coloured laces?
Oh,
and a set. They've been sent to Premier League and Football League teams and all the teams in Scotland in a campaign to support any gay footballer that wishes to come out, as it says. As it says here, it's brilliant. It shows Paddy Power, the betting company, has shown the chance of there not being a gay footballer among the 5,000 professional players in Scotland is more than a quadragintillion to one. So,
is the idea that if you're a gay footballer that you should wear these rainbow laces?
The problem is that no footballer has actually come out as being gay. And in the top four professional leagues in England and Scotland, the chance of there not being gay player in there is incredibly small when you consider how many players there are to each
team. So your idea of the laces is to say, if you are gay, you can come out, it's no problem, just do it. Yeah, to encourage them.
Yeah, and I think that's a really nice thing, because it's had a positive effect in all forms of sport and athletics and rugby and cricket, but nobody in football has yet come out. I mean, some footballers come out after they've retired, but not while they've been playing. And it's definitely something that needs to be tackled, I think.
Okay. Jason, I asked you before we started today about ATOS, and you said, oh, there doesn't seem to be any news, but I've got some news for you from PR Week. I don't know if you take that magazine, do you?
I don't.
Ah, well, that's probably why you haven't read the story. ATOS hiring Edelman to emphasise their non-benefits work. Now, this is a big public relations firm. These are the spin doctors. Some would call them liars. I wouldn't, of course, but some people do. The idea is, of course, to give an impression to the public that ATOS is a wonderful company, when in fact they potentially may be actually a dreadful company. But they can pay the money that they make from being dreadful to a PR company to totally change their image. ATOS, the firm that currently holds a government contract to conduct assessments of benefit claimants, has hired Edelman as it seeks to emphasise other strengths of the business. So
who are Edelman's other clients here?
Well, I'm not sure, but the idea is that ATOS is being seen, it seems, around the world, particularly in Britain, as the company that does these nasty assessments and nothing else. So their image has plummeted through the floor, and they're desperately trying to resurrect their image and say, well, actually, we don't just cut people's benefits off who are disabled and do other sorts of evil things. There is another part of our business. Oh, well, quite what it is, we will probably find out.
Well, they are an IT firm, so I'm assuming it's going to go into the IT industry, their work in the IT industry.
Yeah, so next time you see some sort of media stunt to do with ATOS being wonderful, you'll know where that government money went that we paid to them. It went to Edelman, the public relations firm that makes everything, however smelly, smell nice.
Now, the thing with Edelman is, I'm not sure about this, but if memory serves me correctly, they're connected to a few of the fracking companies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. Okay, anyway, thanks very much, Jason. Good to talk to you again, and see you again next week.
Thank you, Tony. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for listening, and so until the same time next week, goodbye for now.